From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, in for Jim Fleming. Maybe you dream of swimming with dolphins, soaring with eagles, or running with wolves. If you dream of wildness, chances are you found a way to get at least a bit of it into your life. In this hour, conversations with people who've walked a little on the wild side.
Probably, I think, the most enchanting story I heard was a guy who had been in Borneo, out in a canoe, and he talked about a flock of butterflies, and he said you really could hear the sound of their wings.
From butterfly wings to whale songs, stories of encounters with wild nature. And who says the experience of wildness has to mean trekking off to Borneo or the Amazon jungle?
I was with my dad when he died, and hearing his breathing slow, and I was with my daughter when she was born, and these are wild moments too. So for me, the key to wildness is its integration with our so-called normal lives.
The real meaning of wildness in this hour, beginning with the song of a humpback whale. That's the sound of musician and philosopher David Rothenberg serenading a humpback whale with his clarinet. And as you can hear, the whale, incredibly, seems to be singing back. This is part of David Rothenberg's personal quest to play music with animals. A few years ago, he did it with songbirds. Now he's released a new recording of duets played in the wild with humpback whales, belugas, and orcas. He's also written a book about the experience. It's called Thousand Mile Song. Rothenberg told Steve Paulson that he's always been fascinated by the way musicians have worked recorded whale songs into their music, but he wanted to try something different.
I really wanted to take my own approach, which is to go out and play live with these animals, take my clarinet and play along with whales. Of course, they're underwater, and I'm above the water. So how do you do this? Well, you take the clarinet and play it into a microphone that goes into an underwater speaker, broadcasts the clarinet into the sea, and the whales can listen. And then meanwhile, you have another microphone underwater called a hydrophone. And there I'm listening to what the whales are doing together with what I'm playing, even though I'm staying dry on the boat.
So what kinds of whales were you trying to play music with?
Well, humpback whales are the ones with this famous, long, complex musical song that's really the longest song made by any animal, probably longer than human songs, because they actually can sing for up to 24 hours in a very structured way. The song itself is about up to half an hour in length that they're repeating in a very organized, structured way.
So you're saying for a half an hour at a time, that's kind of a song in itself. There's a particular structure within that.
There is, which was amazingly discovered and described by Scott McVey and Roger Payne in 1970. And since that description of that song, people have tried to figure out more about what it means, when it's sung, what it's for, and in a way we haven't learned all that much about it because it's really hard to figure out what these whales are up to down there. We know they're singing this incredible music and there's certain surprising things about it, like it's always changing, but they're all singing the same song.
All the whales within a particular pod are singing the same song.
Oh, within a particular ocean, not just a pod, but in one ocean, or in one half an ocean, North Pacific or South Pacific. In the North Pacific, all the humpback whales are singing one song, and it changes. Some innovation appears. All the whales pick it up right away, and they sing it together. So unlike certain birds, the whales are not trying to distinguish themselves by singing something different. They all want to sound the same. If they all want to sound the same, why bother changing it at all? We don't know. No other animal does anything quite like that.
And isn't it true that only the males of humpbacks are the singers?
That's true. Only the males sing these long, beautiful, complex songs, and usually happens during the mating season, in the winter, in the tropics. And so most scientists want to believe it's to attract the attentions of females. However, we've never seen a female humpback whale show any interest in a whale who's singing. So maybe it's about something else entirely. I talk about these scientists, Jim Darling and Flip Nicklin, who spent 10 years really paying attention to what happens when a male humpback whale is singing, alone, all by himself, suspended, kind of motionless, 40 feet down in the water. Most of the time, a whale sings alone, stops singing, goes off. You see no interaction. But when they did see another whale approach, which they only saw about 200 times in 10 years. It's not that much. They have to go out a lot. What they saw was this. Another male whale arrives. The first one stops singing. The two of them go off silently together for a few minutes, and then they separate, also in silence. What does this mean? What's happening? We have no idea.
Are you willing to speculate? I mean, one of the virtues of talking with you is you're not a scientist. You're a musician right. who likes to kind of think about big questions.
I think, well, I'll tell you what, Jim concludes, and he does so in a tentative way, because after all, his research boat is named the Never Satisfied, which is just great. He's never satisfied with what he's come up with. We just don't know that much about these whales. He says somehow this song must help to organize the males together in a way that's necessary for mating to happen somehow. Musically, I kind of think bird song and humpback whale songs are examples of how animals actually make music. They communicate, but they're not communicating information in a way we could translate and say this sound means that or this sound means this in a very clear way. They're singing a performance. It has a beginning, middle, and end. Certain notes are right. Certain notes are wrong. Evolution has produced music in the natural world much more than it's produced language. These animals are really singing. We're not just calling them songs. Bird song doesn't have a lot of information in it. They're pieces of music, and these animals have evolved to make music.
Are there any similarities between bird songs and whale songs?
Oh, between humpback whale songs, yes. If you speed up a humpback whale song, it sounds a lot like a kind of rhythmic bird song, like a mockingbird or a nightingale. You know, it's not the same structure, but you hear a lot of the similar kinds of elements put together. What does that show, that there's a similarity? I mean, it shows a kind of thing that there, at different levels of life, there's kinds of patterns that are produced by whole different evolutionary paths, where whales evolved one way, birds some other way, but they're making similar kind of music. Does that mean this music is universally beautiful, appreciated the same way by different species? We don't know.
Also makes you wonder if they're just doing it for fun.
They might be. You know, it's easier for scientists to cut open dead whales and see what's going on in their brain rather than observe what they're doing because they're so big and they can't live in captivity. But they found in the brains of humpback whales something called a spindle neuron, a kind of neuron that previously was only found in animals that we think can experience higher order kinds of emotions, like primates. And now the same kind of neuron is in the brains of whales. One more bit of evidence that, not necessarily that they're smart, but that they can really feel. They have intense feelings.
And yet, what's so mysterious, of course, is that we really don't know anything about the emotional lives of whales. I mean, we know a lot about chimpanzees. We can sort of guess because they're so closely related to us and act in many similar ways. But whales, these extraordinarily intelligent animals, are so different and, because of that, so mysterious.
Absolutely. And I think it's really the song of the humpback whale that really led people to care about these animals. When we heard that song, we first heard it, it was immensely captivating, moving, and beautiful, and made these animals that previously were just thought of as large sources of oil and meat, that they had this sound, this feeling. And I describe in the book Scott McVeigh's trip to Japan, where he was playing these songs for all of these important people in the government and whaling industry and such, and playing these songs that no one knew about, and you know, he describes how this one whaling executive just sort of starts to burst into tears. We didn't know. We didn't know. We had no idea that they were singing. On the other hand, they're still killing as many whales as they can out there.
Right.
Later he asked a friend about that, a Japanese scientist, who says, oh, in Japan, ethics very slippery. As it probably is everywhere in the world. Right. You know, people can be moved by something and then turn around and forget about it when they thinking about something else, but there's no doubt that these songs are moving and beautiful.
You have a remarkable recording from Hawaii, which you call Never Satisfied, and it sounds like you and the humpback whale are riffing off of each other. Do you think the whale was really responding to your clarinet?
I believe so. You know, I have no proof in the scientific sense. I have to do 100 of these things and study differences. But But one example can be enough for music, and I really hear that, there's this real interaction. And if you know that these animals change their songs very rapidly, even from week to week, presumably someone comes up with a new idea and others copy it, it's no surprise to me that they would respond to a clarinet much faster than, say, a bird would. Birds take longer to change their songs. So it didn't surprise me. It surprised a lot of scientists I played this to. They said, "You made this up. This is a studio concoction." I said, "Well, no, other pieces on the record are studio creations, but this is live underwater clarinet and humpback whale. This is what happened."
We've been talking mainly about humpback whale songs, but other whales also sing. Belugas, for instance, what do they sound like?
Well, belugas use sound in a more conversational way with a lot of different syllables, much more like dolphins, and people have tried to communicate with them for a few decades and teach them sounds. And in aquariums, belugas are very good at learning human sounds. And I practiced in the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, playing clarinet for 3 days along with belugas there. And on the third day, you know, a whale was definitely copying some of the sounds that I made. Then I went to the wild in Russia, in the White Sea, in the Republic of Karelia, in the Arctic, to play along with wild belugas. And there I sat on shore, waited till the whales came. They came wherever the tide was high. Same kind of thing with the hydrophone, listening underwater, the underwater speaker. And there you had a much more alien-sounding mix of clarinet with squeaks and rattles and all kinds of crazy sounds. And there, you know, I have much less of a sense of what's going on there.
What other species of whales did you play music with?
I also played with orcas, or killer whales, off Vancouver Island. The sounds of these whales, particularly that population of them, are the most studied. When you hear the sound of an orca in the Pacific Northwest, you can identify exactly which pod and family and clan it's from, because each one has different sounds.
It suggests that there's something about culture going on here. I mean, if each group has its own sound, its own distinctive sound, I mean, these sounds bond them together in some way.
That's right. It's generally believed that the behavior of many different species of whales is a form of culture, which means it's behavior that's learned and passed down from parents to children, from one generation to the next. It's not genetic. Like, you can have two groups of killer whales, of orcas, living in the same area. One group just eats fish, and the other group eats mammals, and they have whole different behaviors associated with the kind of hunting they do to get this different kind of prey, and this includes different kind of sounds. So this is generally believed to be a kind of culture-learned behavior different groups of whales have that distinguish one group from another, even when they're living in the same place, which is very unusual among animals, you know, overlapping populations living in whole different ways.
Philosopher David Rothenberg writes about playing his clarinet with orcas in his new book, Thousand Miles Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. Steve Paulson talked with him. You might have to travel a bit to hear a whale sing, but there's another song anyone with even a bit of backyard or a tiny piece of green space can hear. Insect songs. By late July, in most parts of North America, the air is filled with an orchestra of insect calls. We hear them, but we don't actually see much of the insects who make them. Most of us would prefer not to. Nobody I know is out with a magnifying glass trying to spot a marshmallow grasshopper or a northern bush katydid. But maybe we're missing out on something pretty special. Jennifer Angus is an artist who finds insects so beautiful she uses them in her work. She's developed an international reputation as an artist who fills entire galleries with large-scale installations made entirely of insects.
So we've got various types of cicadas here. This one with about the 8-inch wingspan comes from Malaysia, and I do believe it is the very largest cicada. We've got one with blue wings.
Jennifer Angus is showing me her studio, a room literally filled to overflowing with bugs. Every corner of the room is stacked with wooden crates and plastic bins filled with thousand upon thousand of cicadas, weevils, beetles, grasshoppers, and moths,
They're really incredibly beautiful wings. And these ones are orange. I have ones that are purple and blue and pink. They're
I'm not much of an insect lover, but pinned out on a board here, their wings stretch delicately out to the sides. They are beautiful.
It almost looks like it's wearing a ballroom gown. It's so beautiful. The brown.
Jennifer Ankus is no more natural an insect lover than I am. She started out as a textile curator. During a trip to northern Thailand to document tribal dress, she stumbled on a garment decorated with green metallic beetle wings.
I did have one. Oh, here it is. Okay. Here you see these hard, this is the hard outer wing.
Never do they just look like little green jewels.
Yeah, exactly. And really, I grew up in Canada, you know, everything's black, brown, bites, stings. I don't like insects. But I saw these, and it just captured my imagination.
Textile work took her next to Japan, where she struck up a friendship with a group of children who kept insects as pets.
There were three boys who came every day because they had discovered I was interested in insects. We didn't have a common language, but we had a common interest. And really, for the boys' amusement, they would leave the things that were dead for me. And so for their amusement, I started dressing up these large rhino beetles in paper kimonos. And then I had a dung beetle as a sumo wrestler.
Before long, Ankus was collecting insects herself. By now, she works with a whole network of specimen dealers who send her insects from Thailand and Malaysia, where they're collected by indigenous people who live in and around the rainforest. Today, when a gallery hires Jennifer Ankus, she and a team of assistants move into the space and they pin literally thousands of insects in elaborate patterns all over the walls, kind of like 3D wallpaper. It's meticulous work and it takes a long time to set up.
I'm pretty good at it. I can do about 10 an hour.
How many insects are in most of your exhibitions?
A large exhibition has on average 14 to 15,000 insects. When people walk into the space, initially they see a pattern. And then they walk up and there's this discovery. Oh, that pattern is made up with insects. And of course, what's the one thing you don't want in your house? Insects. So really, literally, I've seen people take a step backwards.
People have mixed reactions to Ankus's exhibitions. Most visitors, she says, kind of enjoy the tension of feeling attracted and repelled at the same time. Some, however, look at the walls and see nothing but death.
I had a person who really didn't like my exhibitions, and she was going on about how could I sleep at night? Did I have bad karma with all these dead bodies? I sleep just fine. I really see my insects as ambassadors for their species, that they are mature insects. If they were immature, they'd be larvae and frankly not that interesting up on the walls. So I think one can presume that they've had the chance to procreate. So I like to think they have an extended afterlife in my exhibitions because if they were out in nature, then they would just, you know, die and decompose back into the earth. So I think that they've got a lot to tell people and teach people.
Most people actually find Jennifer Ankus's work enchanting. Seeing walls filled with sunburst and star patterns or big swirling nebulas composed entirely of insects, people often, oddly, remember their childhood. They tell her stories about heading out on summer mornings, butterfly net and bug jar in hand, of lying on their stomachs in long grass, watching beetles and ants build nests. It's an odd thing that, as kids, we find insects fascinating. We read Charlotte's Web and we sing about the eensy-weensy spider, and then we grow up, see a bug, and reach for the can of Raid.
It's something that I've considered a lot, that we have a soft spot in our heart for insects in children's literature, but then as we get older, they become dirty. One thing I've learned through my exhibitions is that people are okay when the insects are in patterns. It's a form of control. But they get quite upset if I put them in what I would call a more natural formation, sort of swarming into the corner. Oh, they can't stand that. No one wants to be around there. So that's, you know, it's man's pursuit to control nature.
Considering by just how much insects outnumber humans on the planet, that desire to control their population is kind of understandable. In any case, Angus says the main thing she's learned from watching people react to her show is...
We all have a feeling about insects, whether it's good or bad.
And you can see pictures of Jennifer Angus's work on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, happy memories of a childhood spent catching butterflies and watching them die. And a nature writer who says he's sick of nature. I'm Anne Strain-Champsian. For Jim Fleming, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Sometimes you have to kill nature to understand it. Charles Darwin killed reams of animals for his collection on board the HMS Beagle. Those specimens later helped him crack the mystery of evolution. In our time, Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson once fumigated an entire island so he could see how the birds and insects repopulated it. And on a much humbler scale, essayist Anne Fadiman has fond memories of a childhood spent collecting butterflies. In a new essay called Collecting Nature, she writes that although she and her brother taught themselves a lot about insect identification, they also felt a certain thrill in the kill. Fadiman read a passage from her essay for Steve Paulson.
When did we realize that this was horrible? My brother and I had started collecting butterflies when he was 8 and I was 6. Shame set in about 2 years later. I remember a period of painful overlap when the light of decency was dawning, but the lure of sin was still irresistible. Like alcohol, nicotine, or heroin, lepidoptery is hard to renounce. A tiger swallowtail is an unbelievable thing to find in your backyard. A big butterfly, 5 inches across, striated with yellow and black, with blue splotches on the hind wings, rendered iridescent by light diffracting scales. Who would not wish to take such a creature home? To swoop your net through the air and see something fluttering inside? To snatch that bit of life from the rich chaos of nature into your own comparatively lackluster world, which had instantly brightened and enlarged? To look it up and name it and know it? Well, after you did that a few times, it was hard to muster much enthusiasm for Parcheesi.
What you get at in this essay is both the joy of insect collecting, but also the sad fact that it involves a lot of killing. You almost can't have one without the other, can you?
Well, there are some kinds of nature collecting that don't involve killing. You can collect shells along the beach that have already lost their animals. You can collect an abandoned bird's nest. But if you're going to collect butterflies, you pretty much have to kill them. And that's the difference between collecting butterflies and collecting stamps. You don't have to murder the stamps.
And this is an old story in natural history. I mean, some of the great biologists throughout history were also great collectors, and they didn't seem to have any qualms about killing for their collections.
They had no qualms because collecting enabled them to form their theories. That is, the three great biological theorists of the 19th century, Alfred Russel Wallace, Henry Walter Bates, and Charles Darwin, were all collectors. And when I say collectors, I mean collectors on a really, really big scale. When Wallace went to the Malay Archipelago in the 1860s, he brought home more than 125,000 specimens. Imagine. And when Bates went to the Amazon, he came back with 14,000 new species that he had discovered. And Darwin, of course, was able to develop his theory of natural selection only by examining all the specimens that he brought home, the ones that he'd so carefully cleaned and stuffed and pickled while he was fighting seasickness in the poop cabin of the HMS Beagle.
For someone like Wallace, at least, he seemed to be pretty upfront about the thrill that came with not only catching the thing that he was collecting, but also killing it. At one point, he referred to the excitement to feel it struggle between one's fingers.
Yes, he did. Interestingly, in a later reprinting of that particular passage, that phrase was left out. I think it was regarded as too shocking. But for Wallace, that was the crucial difference between seeing a specimen in a museum and catching it yourself. The murder was part of the excitement.
Now, like many of us, you were a collector yourself as a kid. You write about how you and your older brother would go out collecting insects. Did you take a certain amount of pleasure in the kill?
Up until a certain age, partly because it was so exciting to have that power. I started collecting butterflies with my brother when I was 6. And when you get a butterfly in a net, of course, it's tremendously exciting that you've plucked out of the sky something that is yours. But it becomes even more yours if you kill it. That is, if you put it in the killing jar, which has carbon tetrachloride in the bottom, and then you put it in the relaxing jar, which enables you to push the wings down and flatten it, and then you put it on the spreading board, and then you put it in a Riker mount. A few years later, it dawned on me and my brother that we were doing something truly horrible. But I think that for us, it was a childlike analog to what hunting might mean for an adult man, a way to go out into nature and feel that it's yours.
Hmm. Now, there's another piece to animal collecting. It's not just the catching of the animals. It's also the naming of them and the classifying of them. This is really the basis of natural history, isn't it?
It is the basis of natural history. It's saying these two things look alike. How closely related are they? How can we divide the world into families and genera and species? And in the 19th century, when people were particularly foraying out from England and going to other continents, I think it was a form of imperialism. That is, when they saw an animal that had probably had a local name for centuries and said, I name it X, and then they gave it a double name, Latin, Linnaean nomenclature, it was like saying, we are taking this thing from Africa or Asia or the Malay Archipelago, and we're making it a little British Crown colony.
Now, I get the sense that you and your brother had your own quite extensive collection of all kinds of things, not just insects, but other stuff. And you have a passage about this. I'm wondering if you could read that.
I would be happy to.
And this was what you called the Serendipity Museum of Nature?
Yes, the Serendipity Museum of Nature, no smoking, please, as the blue Dymo label maker sign on the door read. We displayed not only things that had once been alive, but things that had once contained life. The discarded skin of a garter snake, the exoskeleton of a cicada, the speckled egg of a scrub jay, the pendant nest of a Baltimore oriole. Blowfish dangled from the ceiling on strands of dental floss. In the southeast corner, pinned to the wall, were scraps of fur. Leopard, tiger, polar bear, rabbit, otter, nutria, mink, left over from coats tailored by a local furrier. Next to them was a man-sized piece of styrofoam into which we'd stuck hundreds of feathers. On the west wall, we had nailed a desiccated sand shark, which looked like a crucified demon. Shelves and card tables held, among other things, a stuffed mouse, a stuffed bat, the skeleton of a pit viper, a hornet's nest, a mounted ostrich egg, a hunk of petrified wood, the fossils of ammonites and foraminifers, several dried salamanders, a dead tarantula, 3 dead scorpions, a sperm whale tooth, a box of our own baby teeth, the foot of an egret, a pickled squid, a pickled baby octopus, and a pickled human tapeworm, about which I am said to have exclaimed when I received it on my 10th birthday, just what I always wanted. There were also about a dozen bird and mammal skulls that we had retrieved from road kills and cleaned with bleach. Pending their Clorox baths, our mother permitted us to wrap the corpses in aluminum foil and store them in the freezer, as long as we labeled them clearly enough to prevent her from confusing them with dinner.
I have to say, you had very understanding parents.
We had really understanding parents. They let us fill a spare bathroom with dirt in order to keep a California king snake. They let us nail whale baleen to the wall. They let us do a whole lot of things that I probably wouldn't let my own children do. But thank God that I had my parents as parents and didn't have me.
Anne Fadiman's most recent essay collection is called At Large and At Small. She spoke with Steve Paulson.
You know, I think the thing about hummingbirds that still fascinates is they can fly backwards and forwards. They look like they're not really anything at all. They're these little flying jewels.
Did you know that hummingbirds inspired some of the 19th century's greatest writers? From Emily Dickinson to Mark Twain? We'll tell you the story in a few minutes. But first, David Gessner is a nature writer who's sick of nature. Sick of trees, sick of birds, sick of the ocean, or at least sick of the tone of hushed reverence we use to write about them. Gessner calls that tone the gentle straitjacket of the nature writing genre. As a writer himself and editor of an environmental literary magazine called Ecotone, Gessner tries to practice what he preaches. In a recent essay called My Green Manifesto, he makes the case for wilder, messier, more eccentric writing. He told Steve Paulson that for too many writers today, nature is like your great aunt, treated with way too much reverence.
I recently called it a genre with hardened arteries, and some of those conventions get tiresome because they're conventions and therefore lack surprise and they're predictable. I want language that breaks out and has wildness, which is one of the reasons we go to nature in the first place, is for things that are wild and surprising. And it's funny how nature writing, which particularly in this time where it's, you know, green everything, you'd think it would be enjoying kind of a rebirth, but it seems kind of marginalized. And I think part of the reason of that, it's about as sexy as quilting right now.
Well, who do you see as some of the greatest nature writers out there, either past or present?
One of the conventions of the genre, of course, is quoting Thoreau. But what I love about Thoreau, the interesting Thoreau to me, is almost kind of the artist who creates this character that's conflicted. You've got a chapter called Higher Laws.
You're talking about in Thoreau's Walden.
In Walden, yeah. You've got a chapter called Higher Laws where Thoreau, you know, basically shudders daintily at all these imperfections of man and the muddy human being. But then in the middle of that, he suddenly sees a woodchuck going across and he wants to basically mug it and devour it for the wildness it represented. I loved that moment because it showed this conflicted, contrary human being. A very similar, more contemporary moment occurs in Ed Abbey's Desert Solitaire when he's in Arches and he's sitting on his trailer with a cup of coffee. He's sitting in the stoop outside his trailer, basking in the sun with a cup of coffee, and he's having this kind of transcendent moment. And a rabbit goes by and impulsively he tosses a rock at the rabbit, which is, you know, totally bizarre, inappropriate, but beautiful because it's not the nature saint, you know, quietly sitting there meditating. It's this conflicted, strange person, which brings with it interest.
Well, it's fascinating what you're saying. I mean, you're raising a couple of points here. One is that there's something about nature in its true wildness that's pretty threatening to us. To really be immersed in that can be overwhelming.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that's one of the complicated ways we should write about it, and the language we should use should be complicated.
Well, the other thing that these examples suggest is you're trying to put the human back into nature. Nature writing is not just a matter of sort of describing this pristine wilderness as if people aren't there. People actually are there observing this and often experiencing it.
Yeah, there has to be a human story. Since humans are reading it, skunks and chipmunks aren't reading it, humans are reading it. There has to be a human story to pull the readers into this world where they can experience the natural world. An example in my own work, I had a book called Return of the Osprey. And I'd recently recovered from testicular cancer. At the same time, ospreys had recently come back to Cape Cod after being all but wiped out by DDT. And I was learning about these birds, and it was so personally thrilling to me. And I watched the season as the birds mated, the young hatched, they started to fledge and fly. I watched the whole cycle, and it was this kind of monomaniacal immersion in the birds. But when I went to putting it in a book, I thought, boy, these are facts are going to be very dry for the average reader, you know, to read all these things that were so fascinating to me. So I kind of created a character who happened to be myself who got immersed in that and got excited about it and got monomaniacal about it. And I think, or at least I hope, that that's the reader's entry into the natural world.
When you say you created a character, which was you, are you saying you made up that character to some degree, or was this all true, what you wrote about yourself?
Well, of course, we're not allowed to say these things in the age of James Frye, right? But as a nonfiction writer, you are always creating that character to some degree. You know, I always say it would have been scary if Thoreau was put on Oprah, because her first question would be, you say you spent a year in the woods, and it's no, it's actually 2 years and change compressed into a year. You know, there are all these aspects of creative nonfiction where we're building and creating the characters in the books. There's a difference between that and outright fabrication, obviously.
Didn't Thoreau also go back for regular meals with his mother?
Yeah, he gets a lot of flack for that one. But, you know, he went back on Sunday sometime and did his laundry. But I think the whole symbolic importance of going there was this great kind of artistic solution to his life. You know, there's a reason the first chapter is called Economy. The big pressing question for him and so many young artists is, how do I live while I'm doing this thing? How do I survive? And he basically did it by, you know, cutting down on everything he possibly could and focusing on the natural world and the work.
And that's instructive because it really was a book about himself in a way. I mean, it's about his own grappling with how to live in the world. But it, by doing that, it was a celebration of nature.
You know, there's that line on the first page of Walden, which is basically, I wouldn't talk about myself if there were anyone else I knew as well, which is a great line for the age of memoir, too. But I think the use of memoir in nature writing is a great opportunity because, you know, memoir gets knocked pretty hard these days. But whatever you want to say about it, it's interesting to learn about someone else's life. And if you can thread that life into writing about the natural world, you get a great combination of looking inward toward the self and outward toward the world. And that, for me, is really exciting writing.
Isn't one of the occupational hazards of nature writing that you're, for the most part, preaching to the choir? I mean, ostensibly, you're out there trying to convince people to save nature, to save the natural world, but pretty much the people who are going to read your stuff already believe that.
That's exactly that. You just, you know, hit the nail on the head there. That is a great problem with the genre, and I just wrote a piece called My Green Manifesto. And one of the things I'm trying to say in there is we've got to use everything we can, humor, bluntness, everything non-naturey, you know, just anything to like stir people who aren't naturally going to be interested in this sort of thing. And the whole idea for me is to mix things up again and get the language muddied and get it out of that little ghetto of nature writing.
Now, we were talking earlier about wildness, and that's an idea that Thoreau wrote about and a lot of other people have written about since. What does wildness mean to you?
Well, it's been pointed out by quite a few people that it's constantly misquoted, Thoreau's famous quote as, in wilderness is the preservation of the world. You know, it's in wildness is the preservation of the world. And I think that's so important. And one of the reasons it's important is we get kind of the nature calendar view of nature where we think wilderness is in Alaska, wilderness is the Himalayas, wilderness is some other place. And what wildness means to me is the possibility of states beyond the human and moments where we interact with species other than our own in our lives, in our normal. You know, I always say my greatest nature moments have been on Cape Cod watching humpback whales off my home beach. And that's greater than any when I've traveled to South or Central America. There was something wild about it happening at home. Similarly, I've had wild moments where, you know, I was with my dad when he died and hearing his breathing slow, and I was with my daughter when she was born. And these are wild moments too. So for me, the key to wildness is its integration with our so-called normal lives, that it's not something we go to beyond our quotidian day-to-day lives. I mean, I guess wildness is ineffable. You know, it's a state that we all define differently that's, you know, beyond the predictable, beyond the boring, beyond the everyday. And for me, you know, humor gets at wildness. That's why I'm not emphasizing humor in nature writing because I think it should be yuck, yuck, you know, big jokes all the time. But I think humor, if you actually go camping or backpacking with people, it's amazing how, you know, somebody's always got a bottle of something. You're always drinking a little bit. jokes are flying. It's a much more exhilarating and free-for-all experience than the experience of, you know, this image of kind of the tight-lipped, serious, earnest nature people.
David Gessner talked with Steve Paulson. Gessner's books include Sick of Nature and Soaring with Fidel, an Osprey odyssey from Cape Cod to Cuba and beyond. And you can read his Green Manifesto online at Ecotone. Visit our website for the link. It's at ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps in for Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Up here in the north, after baseball starts, but before the NBA finals are over, the hummingbirds return. It's always such an astonishing thing to see, as though a golden snitch suddenly appeared in your yard. A little winged jewel that apparates out of nowhere, hovers at top speed, and then vanishes. Back in the late 19th century, there was actually a hummingbird craze. Writers like Emily Dickinson and Mark Twain fell in love with them. Famous artists painted them, ministers preached about them. Christopher Benfey tells the story in his new book, A Summer of Hummingbirds. It's a story he uncovered while he was researching the intersecting lives of a group of writers and artists in 19th century Amherst, Massachusetts. The one thing they all had in common was hummingbirds. And as Benfey puts it,
I just followed those hummingbirds wherever they would take me.
You write that there actually really was a kind of cult of hummingbirds around this time in American history and amongst the sort of intelligentsia that you were following. Really? A cult of hummingbirds?
Well, I think I call it an informal cult, and there's probably hummingbird cultists today, too. But I think certain ideas and feelings, religious ideas, scientific ideas, coalesced around the hummingbird for various and bizarre reasons in this Gilded Age period. For one reason, there was a new feeling about nature, that nature was more dynamic, more changing than people had thought about. There was a new feeling about religion and a sort of a search for religious symbols that captured the sort of God of love and nature that was being preached in Protestant churches. And there was a new feeling about love, about human love between people. And hummingbirds seemed a symbol of that. So I think, you know, this remarkable bird that only exists in the New World became a kind of magnet for a lot of different ideas with a very questing, uncertain, traumatized post-Civil War generation.
Let's unpack some of this a little bit. I mean, first of all, I mean, I get the part about the hummingbirds as symbol of a very changeable nature. You know, they're these little flitty things that hardly ever seem to sit still. And I suppose this is a period of time when Charles Darwin's ideas were becoming increasingly popular, which must have really completely changed people's ideas about the natural world.
You know, we all know about Darwin and debates about apes and the birds he was interested in, the Galapagos, but hummingbirds very quickly became a major participant in the debate about evolution. And it was mainly people who did not believe in evolution who said, how could natural selection have created this? You know, something so beautiful, so gorgeous, so patently designed. So there's a real debate about hummingbirds and evolution. It was Darwin's own ornithologist, his sort of personal ornithologist, John Gould, who was the greatest hummingbird painter before Martin Johnson Heed. And Gould tried to get into these paintings the idea that only God could have made these. You know, the irony is that Darwin's ornithologist did not believe in evolution. He believed in creationism. He thought that God just sat down with his drawing pad and said, let's make this little topaz one, and let's make the ruby throat for New England, and let's make a few others with weird things coming out of their ears. And so hummingbirds were a big part of scientific debate.
You mentioned earlier that people also began to see hummingbirds as a new kind of symbol of the divine. Can you kind of flesh that out a bit?
Yeah, what really satisfying about that is that the Maya and the Aztec people worshipped hummingbirds too, and they had, you know, their leading god as the hummingbird god. So in a way, these Gilded Age questers are going backwards and forwards at the same time. Henry Ward Beecher, who's a major figure in my book, by far the best-known preacher, minister of his time, Beecher preached on the question of what God looked like. And for this generation, the idea of an old man with a long beard sitting up in a throne in the sky just wasn't convincing. And they wanted an idea of divinity that was more in touch with their view of nature as being the sort of expression of divinity. And the hummingbird had just that elusiveness. Emily Dickinson has a beautiful poem about hummingbirds that begins with the line, "A root of evanescence, a root of evanescence with a revolving wheel." And that idea of an evanescent god seemed very compelling for this generation.
Well, it's, I think, probably important to remember this is kind of the period of time after the Civil War when it must have felt as though an entire old order had been destroyed. And here were these, you know, brave young men and women, writers, artists, preachers, painters, who were trying to create or figure out what the new order would be.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The more I went into the feelings and moods of these people, the more I realized that they were really a kind of post-traumatic generation, that the Civil War had really made huge changes in everything that they thought was stable and certain. They were really living in a kind of brave new world, and they were looking for symbols that both had some concreteness but also expressed their sense of change.
Well, tell us a little about some of these people you write about, the ones who were falling in love with hummingbirds. There was a famous painter, Martin Johnson Heade.
Martin Johnson Heade is one of my favorite of all American artists. He's very idiosyncratic, very eccentric, both in his personal habits and in his paintings. I mean, this is a man who could easily have fought in the war, who was good with rifles, able-bodied. And in the middle of the Civil War, he picks up everything and travels to Brazil in order to paint hummingbirds.
So did he do for hummingbirds what Audubon did for other birds? I mean, what's notable about Heade's hummingbird paintings?
That was his aim. What he thought he could do was what Audubon had done, which was to track the birds to their lair. Heade knew that nobody who had painted hummingbirds before had painted them from life. So Heade said to himself, "I'm going to go where hummingbirds live." And he painted the South American forest in a way that they had never really been painted before, with a kind of spooky intimacy.
Yeah, they look sort of like paintings of the forest primeval, you know.
Exactly.
Hummingbirds flitting about at the dawn of the planet, almost. There's something beautiful but very wild and primitive
yes.
about the scenes.
And there was a feeling in the early 19th century that maybe the Garden of Eden was somewhere down in South America. And, you know, then Darwin came along and kind of confirmed it and said, you know, I've seen creation taking place on the Galapagos Islands with these finches and their variations. And I think Martin Johnson Heade is, in his own mind, painting the dawn of creation, that in these incredible, almost surreal paintings of hummingbirds and orchids, where the orchids are big and slightly threatening and mysterious, I think he did imagine that he was painting the origins of life.
So now, what did hummingbirds mean to Emily Dickinson? And did she write many poems about hummingbirds?
She did, yes. And she often included hummingbirds in her letters. She would report on hummingbird sighting. She used hummingbirds as a metaphor for how we read letters, how she reads letters by sipping each word from the flower of the envelope. For Emily Dickinson, the hummingbird is a symbol and embodiment of an insight that is really deep in all of her writing, and that is this sense of evanescence. Emily Dickinson seems to have realized early on that she couldn't pin things down. And one of the exciting things about Emily Dickinson's poetry is that sense of continual shifting, motion, change.
Well, actually, when you think just of the rhythm of her poetry, it's a lot like a little darting, hovering, skimming thing.
Exactly.
You know, four words and a dash, and four more words and another dash.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully said. I completely agree with that. She's the poet of dashes in both senses, you know, the poet of dashes as punctuation and the poet of dash as speed. And she sometimes signed that poem, A Root of Evanescence, with the word hummingbird, as though she was the hummingbird who had written the poem about herself, that it's almost a kind of self-portrait.
Hmm. Has uncovering this whole history, the way you have, tracing all these connections, has this changed the way you see the birds themselves?
Yeah, it certainly has. I always loved hummingbirds, but I wasn't a hummingbird obsessive. But now, of course, I've put hummingbird feeders in my garden, and I think I'm almost as excited as Emily Dickinson. When the first hummingbird came to my feeder, I thought it was the most magical thing ever. And I think my friends were a little puzzled at my excitement. But it's also changed the way I thought about that whole Gilded Age period. You know, we think that we know what the Gilded Age was, that it was a time of great political corruption, of great fortunes, of great waves of immigration, of industrialization, and so on. And I think what I uncovered both in the book and in myself was a sort of different climate of emotion and feeling. And those are the hardest things to write about. That's why we love Emily Dickinson so much. That's why I love Martin Johnson Heed so much, that these are artists and painters who do reveal a new climate of feeling, even as they're revealing things we may not have noticed in our own backyards.
Christopher Benfey teaches English at Mount Holyoke College. His latest book is called A Summer of Hummingbirds. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, sitting in for Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Nature Stories, number 61A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickard, and Doug Gordon. Kirill Owen is our technical director, and our executive producer is Steve Paulson. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.